Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind this week, is it possible to stop Alzheimer's before it starts?
We now have the ability to see some of the brain changes during life, and we can see that that is there 10, 15, maybe even 20 years before people develop dementia.
I talked to a doctor who's made it her life's work to diagnose and treat the disease in its earliest stages. Then, the New Yorker's Ken Auletta on massive disruption in the advertising industry and why we should care.
You may not like advertising. You may feel interrupted by it and feel it's intrusive and emotionally manipulative. But my God, it's essential.
First, here's Dr. Risa Sperling. She's director of the Center for Alzheimer's Research and Treatment at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Sperling, let's start with your own personal connection to Alzheimer's, your father. Tell us a little bit about his experience and how that led you to the work you're doing today.
Well, it actually started with my grandfather, who developed symptoms of memory loss and paranoia when I was thinking about applying to medical school.
Wow.
And unfortunately, I watched him decline over about 6 years, and he passed away when I was a first-year neurology resident. And at the time, I remember thinking I was so worried that this would happen to my father or my aunt because we didn't know it was Alzheimer's disease. We called it hardening of the arteries.
Yes.
But the more I learned about Alzheimer's disease in medical school, the more I realized that those were indeed the symptoms he'd been showing. And then, unfortunately, my father, about 10 years later, started to show some of the same signs, very subtle at first. But eventually I realized that, unfortunately, he wasn't going to escape this disease, and he developed symptoms, and he passed away in early 2016.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Such a terrible disease, and I gather for you, early intervention is what you see as key to combating the disease. Tell me what you believe so strongly in that.
So all of the clinical trials we have tried so far have been at the stage of what we call dementia, when people already have very significant memory problems and loss of independence. And we know now that the disease began in the brain 15 to 20 years before that stage of Alzheimer's disease.
How do we know that?
We now have the ability to see some of the brain changes. We call them neuropathology. In the brain during life, we can see evidence of this amyloid plaque buildup in the brain using PET scans, and we can see that that is there 10, 15, maybe even 20 years before people develop dementia. But it's only recently that we've been able to follow people for that length of time to see that, unfortunately, this buildup of amyloid does predict that the majority of these people will develop memory problems and the dementia due to Alzheimer's disease 15 years later.
Now, does that mean that people who've had dementia or Alzheimer's in their families are getting these PET scans earlier and earlier?
Well, right now we are really in the research phase, and there are a number of studies that are aimed at looking at people who do have a family history of Alzheimer's disease. So the study I work on, called the A4 study, about 74% of the people who came in to screen for the study and ultimately qualified to come into the A4 with this evidence of plaque buildup, 74% do have a positive family history. But interestingly, about a quarter of the people who show this amyloid plaque buildup did not have a clear family history. So I think genetics play a huge role, but it's not everything.
What about those who are already showing signs of disease? What's available to them now?
We certainly have several FDA-approved medications. Those really are what I call symptomatic, meaning they're really aimed at trying to make people's memory a little bit better for a short time or make it easier for them to concentrate. But these medications are not aimed at the underlying disease process in the brain. And that's why we really need what we refer to as disease-modifying therapy. That's going after these amyloid plaques as well as the tau tangles that accumulate inside the nerve cells. So I think of it like a cough medicine for pneumonia when you really need an antibiotic to cure the bacteria that are in there. That's the stage we need in Alzheimer's disease. And I think, unfortunately, the earlier we go, the better chance we have. But that's not to say that we should give up on people with symptoms. Again, having seen this personally and as a neurologist who takes care of people, we need to have something for people who are already suffering from the symptoms. And I suspect there we'll need combination therapy, just like we do in cancer, where we're going to really have to be aggressive and try multiple different avenues to try to defeat this disease.
So what you're saying is that once the disease is making its presence known, there's not much or anything that can be done to reverse it.
Well, I don't think we have something yet that will reverse the disease. We do have a few agents that are in clinical trials that have shown that they can remove the amyloid plaque. These are antibodies. And we're hopeful that since those are pretty strong, potent medications, that perhaps if people only have a very mild degree of symptoms, those antibodies might work. But ultimately, I do think we'll have a better chance at really bending the curve of decline by going even before the symptoms are apparent.
Dr. Sperling, what does a brain look like when Alzheimer's disease is present? Can you help me visualize that?
Certainly. Well, if you looked at it once it's out of someone's head, unfortunately, it looks rather shrunken compared to a normal brain. But what these images allow us to do is they actually kind of a dye actually attaches to these amyloid plaques or in a different dye to the tau tangles that are inside the nerve cells. And so that actually makes very pretty pictures when we look at a scan where we can see areas of yellow and red that are showing us that there's a lot of amyloid plaque present. And in other scans, we can see that the tau tangles are present. And one of the most important things we've learned from these scans is that the amyloid and the plaques and the tau tangles seem to actually be related to each other. Even though they're in different parts of the brain, they seem to unfortunately show up in the same people, and they seem to accumulate over time. And that's really important because the hope is if we could start early enough with bringing down the amyloid plaques, perhaps we can prevent these tau tangles that really seem to cause the memory loss.
How hereditary is Alzheimer's?
I think we don't yet know. There are a few genes, such as something called ApoE lipoprotein, and you may have heard about ApoE4, which is a pretty significant risk factor, and it's thought to account for about 60% of Alzheimer's disease. But then there are a whole bunch of genes that have much smaller effects, and people are looking at whether we can create risk scores that account for all of these smaller gene effects that are hard to see one by one. Overall, it's estimated that probably 75% of Alzheimer's disease is, quote, heritable, meaning it has some genetic basis. And I think actually our screening PET data from the A4 study would support that, with 74% showing a family history.
But now for someone without a family history, at least any that a person knows of, how likely is it that one can contract Alzheimer's? Do we have any idea what causes it?
Well, I think we have a good sense of some of the factors that increase the likelihood that people will develop Alzheimer's changes in their brain. And perhaps most importantly, we're learning about what increases the likelihood that people will be vulnerable to those changes, meaning they may not be resilient as the plaques and tangles start, and they may show symptoms earlier. I feel that we don't fully understand, though, the intercept between lifestyle and genetics. This is a really important thing that we need to study.
Yeah, I was going to ask about diet and exercise and atmosphere in which one lives.
Well, I do think that there is evidence that exercise may be protective. I would say that of all the studies done so far, that's the one fairly consistent finding. But what we don't yet know is whether exercise really protects you from getting Alzheimer's changes in your brain, or does it help you hide them, meaning it makes your brain more resilient because the nerve cells are healthier from the exercise. And I think this is an active area of study right now. I do think that diet plays some role, but it's probably a relatively small role compared to the genetics and other factors. And a really interesting emerging lifestyle issue is sleep, because there's more and more evidence that unfortunately poor quality sleep or not getting enough sleep may increase the likelihood of developing the Alzheimer's changes in your brain, as well as certainly when we don't sleep well, our memory is not as good anyway.
Yeah, that's for sure. And can you talk about the differences between men and women as far as Alzheimer's goes?
Absolutely. So this is a topic of great interest and I think very ripe for us to better understand why women are at greater risk. So the first thing, of course, is that women live longer. Men tend to die a bit younger of heart disease and other things. So women, unfortunately, survive to develop Alzheimer's disease. But even beyond that, we're learning that at a given age that women are at increased risk for memory decline. And some work by a fantastic fellow in our group, Dr. Rachel Buckley, which will be presented in Chicago this summer, for the first time shows that it's not because women get more amyloid plaques, but for a given amount of amyloid plaque, unfortunately, they're much more likely to decline cognitively. Yeah. So that's a clue. And I think it might help us. Perhaps it's the tau, or perhaps the response to the amyloid and tau is different in women. And we may need to have treatments that are sex specific.
I wonder about you and your own concern for yourself. Do you follow perhaps your own thoughts about this? Do you make sure to get enough sleep? Do you have a good diet? Do you exercise? What about that?
Well, I frequently feel when I'm seeing patients in my office that I want to tell them to do as I say and not as I do, because frequently I don't sleep enough. I try to eat a good diet, but I'm definitely overweight. And exercise is something I really relish. And so I try to force myself, no matter how busy I am, to go to dance class twice a week at least, because I do think that's important. And I find it very ironic that I have to choose between working on a grant or writing a paper and getting sleep when I know the sleep's better for my brain, but I feel that I'm racing Alzheimer's disease, so I need to be working harder, not less.
Wow. I gather that you actually spent time as an actress in musicals before becoming a doctor. Tell us about that.
So I worked in theater from about the time I was 18 until I was 26 or 27. And I loved theater. I worked in New York, but I started to realize that I wouldn't be fulfilled if I only was a performer.
Do you think that that career in any way helped you in your career trying to understand what Alzheimer's is and does?
Certainly, having a theater background has helped me be able to speak with people and not be too scared in front of large crowds, although I certainly still get stage fright sometimes. But I hope that it helps me with being empathetic, because I think one of the most important things in Alzheimer's disease is to be able to realize how devastating this is for people and understand what they might be going through. And I hope that my theater background reminds me that we need to put ourselves in someone else's shoes and play their role to understand how difficult this is.
Dr. Sperling, I understand that many drug companies have kind of backed out of the search for a drug for Alzheimer's. That must be somewhat discouraging to you.
It certainly is. I guess I can't blame some of these companies, several of whom have invested well over $1 billion in Alzheimer's clinical trial research and unfortunately have not had a success. On the other hand, I hope that both from, of course, companies' job is to make a profit, and they should realize that Alzheimer's disease is really the greatest unmet medical need in the developing world. And they stand to make a profit if we can get a successful drug. But this is definitely the long game. And I think we need to realize that it's going to take a lot of failures. And the most important thing is that we learn from each of the failures. And finally, I'll say that we should all work together. I know that may sound trite, but it used to be that academics worked in one space and pharma companies worked in another, and then the government was separate. And one of the real advances I see is public-private philanthropic partnerships now, where we all see that this disease is way too big and too formidable an enemy that none of us is going to crack it alone. And so I'm very excited by that, where I think pharma is being willing to work with academics, with NIH funding. I've been the beneficiary of a lot of this work, and I think that's really making a difference in Alzheimer's disease so that we can all share our knowledge much more publicly. And truly, a rising tide will float all boats if any one of these studies succeed.
Finally, going back to the fact that both your father and your grandfather suffered from the disease, have you yourself decided to be tested?
That's a very interesting question. At first, I said, well, I won't get tested until I'm eligible for a clinical trial, because I really believe right now that that is how people should be tested in the setting of a carefully controlled research study where the information is explained and, most importantly, that you can do something about it in a clinical trial. But now the next trial I will start will go down to age 50, and so I'm officially eligible, and I'm going to have to think about whether it's time to go get screened once that trial starts.
How do you have to balance that in your own mind, whether to test or not to test?
I think that for me, I would do the test if I could do something that'll help move the research forward. Because really the bottleneck right now is getting enough people into these clinical trials to get answers. So if I'd be a good candidate for a trial, then I think I should consider it. I think you should get the information about your risk when you can do something about it. And I think these clinical trials are the way we're going to do something about it.
But the final question would be whether you would want to know.
You know, I guess I do want to know, but I'm not sure I want to know right now. I have certainly worried that I'm going to lose the race with Alzheimer's disease and develop symptoms before I make a dent. And I am convinced that the earlier you go, the better. Both of my grandfather and my father really started to develop symptoms in their early and actually middle 70s. So I've got a little time, but probably, I think in the next decade, I do want to know, and I hope I'll be able to do something about it.
Well, I thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your thoughts on this really terrible disease that is affecting so many people in this country. Thank you again.
Well, thank you so much for your interest in having me on your podcast.
Thank you. Now a quick break. And we're back. I talked to The New Yorker's Ken Auletta about the future of advertising. But before we hear that, here's something special for Father's Day. I wanted to share with you an interview I did with former Meet the Press host Tim Russert. He died 10 years ago this week.
Well, it's a good time to see you, Tim Russert.
Great to be here, Diane.
When I talked with him in 2004, he had just released a book about his dad called Big Russ and Me. I was so moved listening back to this.
I know this book began to germinate for you back in 1998. What was going on?
I went back home to Buffalo to the New York State American Legion Convention to receive a journalism award, and I brought my son Luke with me. My dad was there, and I spontaneously began to talk about my dad, someone who grew up during the Depression, left school in the 10th grade to fight in World War II, involved in a terrible plane crash as B-24 Liberator burst in the flames, and he barely survived, 6 months in the hospital. And then he came back home and started a second mission, and that was to raise and educate his four kids by working two full-time jobs as a sanitation man and a truck driver. And he never complained. And I have learned so much by the quiet eloquence of his hard work. I wanted to write a book which affirmed his life. And after I wrote it and reread it, I realized it was, I had written as much for my son as for my dad. So I added another chapter, an open letter to my son. And I tell you, Diane, as I've gone around the country, I am just stunned how this has resonated. Everywhere I go, every city, people come to the bookstores and want to talk about their dads.
Of course.
And they want it signed to Big Mike and Big Frank and Big Al and Big Fred. There's a lot of big guys out there. And as we lead to Father's Day of 2004, I have a real sense that there's a feeling in the country that maybe take a day off from Bush versus Kerry and a day off from the Iraq War and say, hey, Dad, thanks for the sacrifice. Mm. Because it is a group of men, and I tried about my mom, and women too, but I tried to stay with the theme of father and son because I have one child, a son. It's a group of people who just sacrificed everything. I said to my dad, you know, Dad, two jobs. Didn't you ever say to yourself, what am I doing this for? He said, some guys couldn't find one. Dad, 6 months in a hospital. You know, you nearly died. That had to be tough. That was tougher for the guys who died. Dad, didn't you ever want to go to school? I mean, finish high school? You kids, you're the first one in the family. You went to college. You went to law school. You're on your way. That's it. He really believes that he's had the greatest life imaginable. His glass is two-thirds full. His favorite expression is, what a country. And he says that when he sees his kid going toe-to-toe with George Bush or John Kerry, when he eats a perfectly charbroiled hot dog. He's just amazing. And I am just so happy at 8 years old he's here to enjoy it and celebrate the life of Big Russ, because I could not do what I do without him.
And you can hear that entire interview on our website, dianereem.org. Now, here is Ken Auletta. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. His new book is Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else. Ken Auletta, how great to see you again.
Pleasure to be back.
Before we take a look at what's happening now, as you write in your book, Frenemies, let's look back at the era of the Mad Men and how advertising worked in that age.
Well, if you go back to the Mad Men show, what you saw was that the creative side of the advertising agency was the dominant side. What's called the media agency, or the media buyers, or the media executives, they played supplementary roles. They were not in the driver's seat. So the client would come, Procter & Gamble, and the creative person would go off and create an ad and rule the whole side of the advertising side of the agency would be geared to the Mad Men. Back in those days, you had Bill Birnbach, who created the famous Volkswagen, or Levi's Rybrand, or David Ogilvy, these legendary figures who were very dominant. I mean, George Lois, who was one of the Mad Men of those days, when a client said, I don't like your ad, he said, you will take my ad or I'll jump out this window.
Wow.
And so they were forceful, dominant people who were not afraid of the client. In fact, they felt in many ways that they had to rule and guide the client. That's totally changed today. Today, the media agency is much more in the driver's seat rather than the creative people, the people who come up with the strategy, who target who the audience might be, and then spend the money. They're the dominant force, and that's a shift in the ad world.
When did you begin to see things change?
It obviously changed sometime in the 90s, and probably the latter part of the 90s. And today, it's just a very different world. I mean, you didn't have Facebook and Google.
Exactly.
And digital, which gives you lots of data. And so the engineer today actually supplants the media agency or the media buyer. The engineer and the data scientist become much more dominant figures in the digital world.
So define the frenemies you talk about in the title.
Frenemy for an ad agency world is they see Google and Facebook saying, we're going directly to the client, to the advertiser, to Procter & Gamble, Unilever, whatever, and we don't have to talk to the agency. We're going to be providing them services. So they become a frenemy, even though advertisers are putting billions of dollars on Google and Facebook's platforms. PR agencies that used to deal with newspapers and magazines, as newspapers and magazines shrink, they say, hey, we'll get into the advertising business. Consulting companies like Deloitte, which used to be your accountant, or IBM or McKinsey & Company, your consultants, they say, we're going to get into the advertising business. We have relationships. The clients say, hey, we're going to take more stuff in-house, and we'll do our own advertising, bypassing the agency. So the agency is surrounded by people who are their friends and business partners in many ways, but also their frenemies. But the biggest frenemy is the public, because basically the public has come to the view that we don't like advertising,
yeah,
particularly on our cell phones.
Right.
And so 20% of Americans have what's called an ad blocker on their phone. Ads can't penetrate. And if you look at Nielsen numbers, 55% of the people who record programs on their PVRs skip the ads.
Of course.
And then you grow up on Netflix and YouTube and HBO, no ads. So people are increasingly turned off by advertising. So that's the existential threat to all of advertising, not just to the agencies, but to the advertiser themselves and the publishing companies and radio companies, et cetera.
So why does that concern you?
Well, it concerns me because if you think about advertising, advertising is the ATM machine to make things free. It basically subsidizes much of radio. It subsidizes much of podcasting. It subsidizes newspapers and television. And Facebook, for instance, 97% of their revenue comes from advertising. Almost 90% of Google's comes from advertising. So without advertising, all these things perish. So people then say, well, the answer is we'll supplant the advertising with subscriptions. But the one thing Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump agreed on in their campaign, maybe the only thing they agreed on, was the fact that the middle class and the working class, which are the majority of Americans, their income has been frozen for the last decade. So how are they going to afford more subscriptions? It's a pipe dream. It's a nice pipe dream, but it's a pipe dream.
You know, it's interesting you talk about that because, of course, many public radio stations exist on subscription.
Yeah, but increasingly you hear ads intruding on those stations.
True.
Because they
underwriting, if you will.
Yeah, and you need it. Now, that doesn't mean you love advertising. It doesn't mean that many of those ads are not manipulative and intrusive. But ideally what you want is good ads that don't feel intrusive, that serve you, and recognition that, my God, we need them as a financial support.
At the same time, Ken, I'd like to challenge you on some of especially the medical ads, the ads for drugs, huge amounts of money come from those drug companies supporting newscasts, But my goodness, they do convince people that if you've got a problem, we've got a solution, no matter what your problem is.
You're not challenging me. I agree with you. The reason you see so many medical ads on, say, newscasts is they know the audience is older.
Of course.
And increasingly, what the advertisers, the advertising world is saying is that we don't have to guess who our audience is anymore. We can actually tell you who was watching what at what time and what effect the ad has on that person. So we'll be able to target them. So, Dan, you know, we know you bought a really nice dress at the store two blocks from where you are walking right now. They know from your GPS where you're walking. Diane, if you go in that store today, we'll give you 20% off a new dress. And you say, is that an ad or is that a service? They're arguing that it's going to be a service to you.
Of course.
On the other hand, at some point, you may say, how do you know so much about me? What gave you the right to know so much about me? So the privacy issue looms large.
Huge. And what, at this point, having already given away our private information online, in our phones, everywhere else, what does the consumer do?
Well, it's a good question. We know what the consumers of Western Europe are doing. They have a law that went into effect on May 25th, 28 nations, the EU, basically, saying that you may not collect my cookies, which are the data of what I search, what I read, what I buy, unless I choose to opt in. In America, the way it works, and much of the rest of the world, the way it works, is that in order for them, an advertiser, not to collect your cookies, Facebook, Google, whatever, you have to opt out. To opt out is very complicated.
How come? Because they want it.
They want it to be complicated. Yeah. They don't want you to opt out.
Right.
And in fact, the advertising community, all the advertising organizations, the digital organizations, the client organizations, the advertising agency organizations have united in this country to oppose what Europe is doing because they don't want it to spread here. And there's much more of a tradition of privacy among the citizens of Western Europe. The question becomes, will that spread? Will consumers in America be so alarmed by the privacy questions, artificial intelligence, facial recognition, reading your eyes and how you do. Will at some point we rise up and say, hey, wait a second, this is going too far? That's a basic question. I don't know the answer to. No one else does. But that's something to watch over the next couple of years.
And if the citizens here in the United States rose up and said, wait a minute, I'm not going to let you do this anymore, how do you stop it? How do you get to a point where you begin to reverse that trend?
Well, it's basically a government regulation, and you would need the government to do that with rules. I mean, you have certain rules now. Liquor cannot advertise on television. There are ads that you're not allowed to do in terms of children's programming. So the FTC and the FCC have regulations that they could impose. And you can break up companies, too. I mean, antitrust legislation. But whether that will happen, I don't know. I mean, when you watch Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, come before the Congress, and you see the kind of semi-literate questions that members of Congress were asking. They were not very sophisticated questions. And he was allowed to give the most evasive answers possible, saying, I'll get back to you on that. Well, he knows the answers to those questions. But they didn't know enough to be able to challenge him, or too many of them didn't know enough to challenge him.
What question, especially, if you had been sitting in a congressional chair, would you have challenged Mark Zuckerberg on?
Well, certainly I would start off by, are you a monopoly? I mean, if you look at 2.2 billion users that Facebook has, and he says there are eight other people in the market who have social networks, so I feel there's competition. Well, he owns half of them, A, and B, he's counting Twitter, which doesn't even make a profit. So, you know, it's he's a dominant, arguably a monopoly in social networking, just as Google with 80% market share. is a monopoly in search. That doesn't mean if you monopolize search or social networking that you want government engineers to come in and break it up.
Right.
I mean, I remember covering the Microsoft trial in 98 and 2000, and the government and Judge Jackson, the initial decision, ruled that Microsoft should be broken up. I thought it was a cuckoo idea, because if you knew anything about the internet and open source software, you knew they were going to be broken up by technological change, and they were. And so I'd be very wary of jumping in and saying break them up. But for instance, if instead of allowing a Facebook to buy Instagram, a potential competitor of theirs, you could have a rule that you may not buy certain companies that could be competitors. It's very hard to see now when you're looking at a company like Facebook with 2.2 billion users, or a company like Google with 80% market share. Imagining someone in the garage like they were at one point, coming in and disrupting them.
Technology has disrupted so many industries, but you wonder why we should care about these ad industries in particular.
Well, I think the reason to care about the ad industry, if you're like me, who've covered the media for The New Yorker and in books for years, and watched the quick death of many newspapers and the loss of all those newspaper jobs and magazines. What happened to Newsweek? What happened to U.S. News and World Report?
Right.
See how thin Time magazine
yep.
is today? And you realize that television, free television, broadcast television, is has a reliance on advertising, and that may go away because of competition from the Netflixes of this world. And places like, you know, Facebook want to get into the video business, as is Amazon and Apple, and they have deep pockets, much deeper pockets than the networks do. So you say, advertising is the funding mechanism for the media. If advertising dries up, what happens to the media? And you may not like advertising. You may feel interrupted by it and feel it's intrusive and emotionally manipulative. But my God, it's essential.
So what is the ad industry doing to address the very concerns you're talking about?
They're shrinking their amount of money they invest in newspaper advertising and magazine advertising, clearly. And I think eventually they will shrink the amount of money they're spending on
television ads as well.
Yeah, no question. And they increasing dramatically the amount of money they spend on digital ads. And 75% of those digital ads are going to two companies, Google and Facebook. So the BuzzFeeds and the Vice and the other digital companies that were seen as upstarts are now suffering some because they're not getting the ad dollars that they were hoping to get, or they once thought they would get from advertising. And those are big changes. I mean, you don't want to have a world where the only money is going to a couple of companies.
So how do you see all of this affecting the way they might change ads so they wouldn't be so offensive, so there wouldn't be so many of them? I mean, I'm watching the news in the evening. It does seem as though there's a mountain of time.
Almost a third of each half hour or hour is consumed by advertising.
So why wouldn't they, knowing how they offend, step back a bit, find another way so Diane Rehm doesn't turn off her television?
Well, they're trying too gingerly, I think. And part of the problem, this is the innovator's dilemma. I mean, they have a business that is generating income for them.
Of course.
And they say, I don't want to give up a third of, my basic source of revenue. So, but among the things they're throwing against the wall to see if they stick, they're saying, well, we'll do, instead of doing almost a third of our program in ads, let's reduce that. Maybe we'll reduce it to a quarter. But we'll charge more because there are fewer ads. That's one idea they have out there. Another idea they have out there is let's do 6-second ads. Instead of 30-second ads, let's do it in 6 seconds. People might like that more. But when you think about that, Diane, imagine a 2-minute block of advertising. If you split that for six-second ads. That's 26-second ads.
Oh, my God.
Who wants to be sandwiched in between that?
Absolutely.
No way. A third thing is you go back to the future, sponsored programming, the way NPR and others do. That's another potential solution. A fourth way that people talk about, which they had more hopes for in 2016 than they do in 2018, is what's called native advertising. Native advertising is essentially a camouflaged ad. It looks like a news story in print, but it's really an ad. A little more subtle than a regular ad. You know, it may be that Colgate-Palmolive is mentioned only twice in a full-page story about Colgate-Palmolive. But it's essentially a trick. And the hope was that it would trick the ad blockers, wouldn't know it's an ad, so couldn't block it. That was one of the ideas. So that's another thing to do. A fifth thing they talk about is the more we know about you, the more we can target it ads, and it won't be an ad. It'll be a service for you. So, Diane, when you're walking by that store and we tell you about that dress and the discount you're going to get, it's like a coupon. And might you find that more attractive than an interruptive ad?
As far as ads are concerned, I think we've got to close with this great quote by Rashad Tabakawala.
You pronounced it right.
I did. Good. I'm glad. Tell me the quote.
Are we talking about the cockroaches?
Yeah.
He was talking about ad agencies. He's saying basically he believes that ad agencies will always have a future. And there were others who, in the chapter who were saying they won't. This was the chapter 18 of a 19-chapter book. And he's a brilliant man and the futurist at Publicis, one of the giant advertising companies. And he said, and I quote, "People say we are dinosaurs. We're not dinosaurs. We're cockroaches. Everybody hates us. Nobody likes to see us. But cockroaches have outlived everyone."
Absolutely fantastic. Ken Auletta, it's great to have you here. Along with, I want our listeners to know that my puppy, Bella, has been seated in my lap the whole time.
Hasn't said a word. Diane at one point gestured, "Don't bang the table." And this puppy is living on her lap without a peep.
It's a great advertising for the puppy. Thanks for being here, Ken.
Thank you, Fab.
Okay. That's all for this week. We'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851. And go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Urib-Lipker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.